This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Evening. The parasha deals, among other things, with the request of the Bnei Gad and the Bnei Reuven to possess land on the eastern side of the Jordan, because it was land which they'd already conquered, because it was suitable for their particular lifestyle and their business interests, which was cattle farming. And the Torah tells us, "Umikne Rav Hoyol Livnei Reuven Livnei God Otsu Moed." And the Bnei Reuven and the Bnei God had an enormous investment in cattle, and they saw this particular area of the countryside, and they proposed to Moshe that that should become theirs. They asked very nicely, "Imatzonu chen beinecho yutan es horetz hazois lavodecho la'achuzo." If we have found favor in your eyes, let this land become your servants as an inheritance. Al ta'avireinu es hayarden, don't take us over the Jordan. Moshe Rabbeinu gets very angry at them, and he says, "Ha'achichem yavoyu la'milchomo va'atem teishufoy." Are your brothers going to go to war and you're going to stay here? V'lomo taniyunis leiv b'nei Yisrael. Why are you making the hearts of the b'nei Yisrael weak? Me'avoyer la'orot Hashem nosam lohem Hashem, from going over to the land which Hashem gave them. Don't you remember this is what your fathers did? When I sent them out to spy out the land, and they went and they came and they made the people scared, and Hashem got angry and he swore that those people will never come into Israel, with the exception of Kolev and Yoshua, and he made the Bnei Israel go around for 40 years in the desert. And now you have followed in the footsteps of your fathers. Tarbus Anoshim Chatoim. You've established a culture of sinning people. Lispois oyed al charonaf Hashem al Yisrael, to pull further anger of Hashem unto Yisrael. Ki teshuvu me'acharov, you've departed from Hashem. Ve'yosaf oyed la'nichli bamidbol v'shichatev v'cholom azeh, you're going to destroy this people because Hashem will want them to stay in the desert another 40 years. And then they say, that's not our intention. We will establish pens here for our cattle. We'll leave the cattle here and we'll go over with our brethren armed and we'll help them conquer the land, and then we'll come back here. Then Hashem makes the deal, and that's how it's, then Moshe makes the deal, and that's how it's left. The Medrash says, Rabbi Shai Yoshev quoted it this morning, Halacha Gimel Matonis Nivru Ba'olam. Three gifts have been created in the world. If a person merits one of them, then he can take the precious treasures of the entire world. It's a key to the world. If a person merits true wisdom, he has everything. If he has power, he has everything. If he has wealth, he has everything. Wisdom, power, wealth. It's interesting, just as an aside, that health isn't one of them. And remember, we've had that before, and much to everybody's consternation and surprise, I mentioned that health is not something that you can't manage without. As much as we all want good health, and obviously it's important, but one can do a great deal of good even if one has to operate from a sick bed, chas v'sholem. And that's why Eliyahu said to Iyuv, "You're lucky it could have been worse, Iyuv, because according to the Shita that Iyuv wasn't poor." So machlokes as to whether Iyuv had lost his money as well as his health. And according to the view Rashi brings up there in Iyuv, that he hadn't lost his wealth, he'd lost his cattle, but not his money. Eliyahu comforts him, says Iyuv could have been worse. And Chazal say, Rashi brings it, what could have been worse? We always talk about the suffering of Iyuv as the ultimate of suffering. What could be worse? So Chazal, you could have lost your money and had your health, that would have been worse. And we don't understand it, because in our Western orientated minds, Health is everything. As long as you've got your health, people say, as long as you've got your health. And I said to you what we should really say, as long as you've got your wealth. That's more important than health. Why? You can't do mitzvahs with health. You need wealth to do mitzvahs. You can't change the world with health. Health is self-centered. We like our health because we're self-centered people, and that's why I say, we say, as long as you've got your health, that means you're a selfish so-and-so, and as long as you're healthy, what do you care? That's really what it means. But if your interests are in the world rather than in your health, than in yourself, then wealth is more important than health. Because one can be bedridden, chas v'sholem, and we say chas v'sholem, it's no pleasant thing, and it's not what one wishes on oneself at all, chas v'sholem. But still, to see things in their correct perspective, a person can be bedridden, but if he has wisdom, if he has chokhmah, he can change the world from his bedside. If he has power, he can change the world from his bedside. If he has wealth, he can change the world from his bedside. If he has health and no wisdom, oof, he can destroy the world. If he has health and no power, health and no wealth, what can he do? What can he do? Chesed he can hardly do. Tzedakah he can't do. Improve things, invest, build. There's a limitation to what he can do. He becomes a drain on society. So we see, and that's why chavivin, tzadikim chavivin mamoinam yosem igufon, that by the tzaddikim, their wealth is more important to them than their bodies. That's a concept which I know a lot of you have a great difficulty with and find and not easy to understand. And something that Chazal emphasized over and over again. Because with an imperfect body, one can still be active, provided one has the wherewithal to be active. The tzaddikim see money as a means of building, as a means of doing chesed, as a means of contribution. That's what how they see money. And their bodies too, that's the purpose. So if you're an outward looking person, if you're a creative person, following on last week's shiur, if you're a person who invests, if you're a person who wants to pluck the fruit of the trees, then you don't need money. Then you need health. Because if you're bedridden, you can't go and pick the fruit of the trees. But if you regard your job as planting the trees and nurturing the trees and growing the fruit, then money is more important than health. Because if you've got money, you can hire people to do it. And you can invest and you can build. So what's important is really, are you outward looking or inward looking? If a person is inward looking, there is nothing more important than health. If a person is outward looking, there is nothing more important than wealth. Spiritual wealth, mental wealth, and material wealth. When we talk about wealth, we're talking about richness, all forms of richness, because a rich person contributes. A poor person, and again, rich person with a capital R, rich in all areas, a person who is rich in mind, rich in culture, rich in civilization, rich in wisdom, rich in money, is a person who can contribute, is a person who can be creative. A person who is poor in mind, poor in culture, poor in money, is a drain on society. Different type of thing altogether. And that's why tzadikim chavivim mamoinam yosem igufom, that their money is more precious to them than their bodies. But it's their money that is more precious to them than their bodies, not than their souls. And here we have an interesting understanding of the whole thing. We find that difficult. Tzadikim, their money is more precious to them than their bodies. How can that be? What's more important than health? So by us, we find it easy to understand the other. Body is more important than money. Health is more important than wealth. Good, fine, very nice. Now, when it comes to tzadikim, what is more important, wealth or soul? Wealth or neshoma? Certainly neshoma. They would never sacrifice one little tiny piece of olam habo. They would never sacrifice for money. So the hierarchy then is by the tzaddikim. Their body is the bottom. Then comes material things, and then of course comes spiritual things. We say no, by us body is most important. Fine. Then at the top is the body, and then below that is money. So you've got the money, the material things, and on top of that is our health. Now where do the spiritual things come? Are we willing to sacrifice our health for spiritual things? Unlikely. Are we willing to sacrifice our wealth for spiritual things? Certainly not. That for sure not. Health, maybe. but not wealth. So the whole thing is a lie. We also regard our wealth more than our bodies. The test is, what are you willing to sacrifice? So you find a person, you'll find people, for example, if they had to sacrifice their lives, al kiddush Hashem, I think everybody in this room would be able to do it. It's not something we want, not something easy, but if our backs were against the wall and we were told, change your religions or I kill, I think most of us would give our lives. So our body is less important than spiritual things, the neshama. We're not willing to sacrifice our goof for our neshama. Fine. But when it comes to coming home from work a little bit early to make the shir, and it might mean sacrificing a deal, how many of us will do that? When it means organizing oneself in such a way that one can manage one's learning Torah as well, that one can live a Torah-dika life, but it means taking a drastic cut in standard of living, how many of us are willing to do that? So what are we doing? We're willing to sacrifice our bodies for Torah, but not our money. So what's our hierarchy? Body at the bottom, like the tzaddikim, but here we differ. Then comes money, then comes Torah, and money on the top. That's if we look at ourselves in truth. If we really analyze ourselves, that's where we hold. But with the tzaddikim it's not so, and that's what we're going to see today, is how the relationship is between tzaddikim's soul and them and their material things. So these are the three wonderful gifts given to the world: wisdom, power and wealth. They're all forms of richness. They're all things needed in order to be effective in the world, in order to be potent in the world, in order to be active and contributive in the world. A person who lacks all these three things cannot be contributive in the world. No matter how, what a tzaddik he is and what a chosid he is, it doesn't help. If he doesn't have chokhmah, nor power, nor wealth, if he has none of the three, what can he really do to make an impact in the world? And if one has one of them, then the whole world is open to one. Amos said, but there's a condition to this. Bizman shehen matnoi shumayim uvois bekeach hatoira. Provided they are gifts of heaven and they come with the keach, with the energy of Torah. Aval gvurosoi v'oshroi shel boso v'adam. But the power and wealth achieved through human efforts, einoi klum, is not worth anything. So there's power and power, and there's money and money, and wisdom and wisdom, it would appear. Although it doesn't say in the Medrash that wisdom achieved through human efforts is nothing. That doesn't say. So it would appear that wisdom achieved through human efforts has some value. Money and power achieved through human efforts has no value. But when one of those three gifts is a key to the entire universe, that's if they come from the Ribbono Shel Olam. And it brings proofs for that. As Shlomo says, Shavti v'ra'ei tachas ha-shemesh ki lo'il lekalim ha-moritz. I've analyzed, I've examined, I've seen that it's not the lightest people who are always the fastest runners. V'lo'i la'giborim ha-milchoma, and not the most powerful people who always win the wars. V'gam lo'i la'chachomim lechem, and it's not the wisest people who do well financially. V'gam lo'i la'nevoinim oisha. V'gam lo'i la'yodim chen, and not people who know are not always the people who are desired. Ki ei sufego yikre es kulam, because all are subject to cycles and all sorts of things in the world. Everybody is subject to that, and nobody escapes it. Up one goes up and one goes down, and it doesn't really depend on who you are. And so the Medrash goes on. Medrash then gives examples of Jewish and non-Jewish people who had wealth, who had wisdom, who had power, and it didn't last. So the Medrash comes to the conclusion it's got nothing to do with whether you're Jewish or not Jewish. There's something else that determines the value of what you have. Why did they not last? Sheloi hoyo matnoson min HaKadosh Baruch Hu el chitfin oisolohem. Because their gift was not from the Ribbono Shel Olam, but they snatched it for themselves. Which is an interesting concept, that we can snatch things which are not destined for us. We can take things which Hashem hasn't given us. And so you find with Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven, sure, you are Shirim, they were wealthy. V'hoyolohem mikne godol, and they had vast flocks. V'chibibu es ma'amoinom, and they loved their money. V'yoshulohem chutz me'eretz Yisrael, and they dwelt outside of Eretz Yisrael. Lefichach gilu tchilo mikol ha'shvotim, therefore they were the first to be exiled from all the tribes. Umi gorom lahem, and what caused that? Al shehifrishu asmon min acheihem bishvil kinyonim. Because they were willing to separate themselves from their brothers for their money. There's a lot in this Medrash that we won't be able to get around to, but let's have a look at some of the points. Firstly, where does the Medrash get it from that they were so involved in their money? It's true that they made a request, but their request made a lot of sense. By them staying on the other side of the Yarden, there's more property available for everybody else. Who should be the one? That land that they've conquered, they're expanding Eretz Israel. That land is best suited to them, it's suited to them more than to anybody else. It makes a lot of economic sense. What they're suggesting is not so ridiculous. And when Moshe accuses them of wanting to back out of the fight, they say not at all, we're quite willing to lead the battle, no problem. But this is the land that we feel from a business point of view, it makes sense that this is where we should be. Where do we see from that their gift was not a gift of God, as the Medrash says? They're willing to be mafrish themselves. And furthermore, how can their gift not be a gift of God? Where did they get this all from? They've been in the desert for 40 years. They came out of Mitzrayim. What situation could be more clear that one's wealth is a gift of God than when for 40 years you've been draying around in the desert and you become wealthy out of it? They weren't doing business, they weren't dealing, they were eating mon all the time. There was no business. The stock markets were closed. There was no estate business, there was no property business going on, nobody needed anything, their clothes didn't deteriorate, their health was fine, so there was no economy. For 40 years they lived in a society in which there wasn't an economy, something like South Africa. And to become wealthy under those circumstances, again something like South Africa, somebody becomes wealthy in South Africa, now he's either a ganav or he's a tzaddik. There's no natural way to become wealthy in South Africa at the moment. So in a situation like that, to become a multi-millionaires with flock, and the Medrash says, but it's chosfulohem, they grabbed it, this wasn't matnas shemayim. What does it mean it wasn't matnas shemayim? What determines whether something is a gift of God or it isn't? What does the Medrash mean by that? And how do we see in the Pasuk that they were so involved in their material beings, in their material requirements? We learned a Medrash this morning in the Ladies' Shir, in the 41st chapter of Iyuv, where Hashem says, Mi hikdimoni v'ashale. Who has preceded me with an indebtedness that I need to pay off? Is there anybody that I need to pay? The Medrash says in the Yalkut Shimoni, Kol mi shepoal imkel yovo v'yitol schore. Anybody who's done anything for me, come and get paid, the Ribbono Shel Olam says. Mi kiles lefonai ad shelo nesati lo neshama. So you'll say, somebody might say, I need to be paid. I praised you, Ribbono Shel Olam, day and night. I praised you. I always praise you. But says the Ribbono Shel Olam, you're praising me using what? Using life. Using your neshama. Who gave you that neshama? Mi mal livnoi ad shelo nesati lo bein. So say, Ribbono Shel Olam, I performed the mitzvah. I brisked my son. Thank you very much, says the Ribbono Shel Olam. And who gave you the son? Mi also tzitzis ad shelo nesati lo talis. Who did the mitzvah of tzitzis if I hadn't first given them a talis? Mi also maikat shelenu sati loigog. Who built a parapet around his roof if I haven't given him a roof? Mi also sukkah shelenu sati loimokum. Who built a sukkah unless I gave him the place to build it on? Mi hifrish peo shelenu sati loisode. Who gave peo, the corners of the field that had to be given to the poor if I didn't give them a field? Mi hifrish trumo meiser shelenu sati loigoren. Who took truma and maaser if I didn't give them produce? Mi hefrish bechorus and maaser for korbanos hashlein nasati leitzoyim. Who separated the firstborn or the maaser behema, every tenth animal, or the sacrifices if I hadn't given them flock? What is the Medrash saying? That every mitzvah we do is not an act which creates an indebtedness in the Ribbono Shel Olam. There's nothing that we do which makes us God's creditors. Everything we do is in response to something which God has already done for us. So before we do the mitzvah, the Ribbono Shel Olam is our creditor. By performing the mitzvah, we can at best, if we really perform the mitzvah with all our strength and with all our power and with the finest of good intention, at best we can re-establish equilibrium. That's all that can happen. And that's why Hashem says, Mi higdimoni v'ashalim, is there anybody that started it off? Is there anybody that set the process off, that did something for me, for whom I have not yet done anything, and I now have to respond, I have to now do something for him? Is there anybody in the entire world whom I owe something to? So the Ribbono Shel Olam establishes a principle, there is nobody in the world that I owe anything to. And this is the basis of God's answer to Eve's questions. Because when a person starts asking why, he's already becoming a shtickel balabos. Why? Why means you have rights. Says the Ribbono Shel Olam, rights? Who is there in this world that has rights? Rights means that I owe you something. That's what a right is. Who is there that I owe anything to? Have you done anything for me which is not in response to something I first did for you? I set it off, I started off. We discussed this morning the whole concept of indebtedness, where we examined two elements of indebtedness. The one element of indebtedness is the importance of recognition of indebtedness, of feeling uncomfortable in being indebted, which we've often spoken about before, the concept of hakoros hatzoyev, of wanting to repay indebtedness. A person, in order to be a moral person, needs to feel uncomfortable if he owes something. If a person doesn't feel uncomfortable when he owes anything, then he is incapable of being moral and ethical. It cannot be. Because the underlying principle in ethics, in any kind of morality, is a desire at least to repay. Not to owe. If I don't feel uncomfortable owing something, then theft becomes okay. In my conscience, it might not be halachically okay, but in my conscience it becomes okay. I can take things which aren't mine and it doesn't make me feel uncomfortable. Not so if I feel a discomfort in indebtedness. And in our kind of society, the whole society is based on feeling comfortable in being indebted. And the building societies don't want you to pay off your bond. They want you to keep your bond. And the banks like you to have an overdraft. They pretend they don't like it just to keep you to keep you nervous a little bit, to keep you under control, to exert their authority over you. But they wouldn't like it if the whole of society came and paid off their overdraft. They would be out of business. They want you to owe them money. There's a certain pleasure in having people indebted to you. And if there's a pleasure in having people indebted to you, you don't want to teach people to repay their debts. You want to teach them to become more and more indebted to you. And our society in many areas has become one where the emphasis is on entitlement. You're entitled to things. Don't worry, you're entitled to it. Everybody's entitled to things they can't afford. That's our society today. People feel entitled. To what? I'm entitled to what other people have got. They can afford it and I can't. Well, I'm entitled to be able to afford it too. And if that means credit and borrowing, then I'm entitled to borrow. It's the same thing. The sense of entitlement has become so intense that it overshadows the desire to be independent of indebtedness. But the basis of the whole Briyat Ha'ilam, the basis of the whole creation of the world, is independence of indebtedness. As the Derech Hashem explains several times, particularly in the beginning, that Hashem wanted us to be the owners of our own goodness. Hashem wanted to do good to us. He wanted to give us. But He wanted us to be able to feel masters of our own goodness. And the only way we can feel masters of our own goodness is if we don't feel indebted for it. Otherwise, there's no Bible. You can't own something which you still owe money on. You can only feel ownership if it's something which you've paid for. So the Ribbono Shel Olam would like us to come to the Olam HaEmes and be delivered and have delivered to us enormous quantities of infinite goodness, and for us to be able to feel Thank you, it's mine. I deserve it. It belongs to me. I'm the owner. I'm the master. How is that possible? So the Rebbeinu creates a world in which we have to work. And through working for it, we can come there afterwards feeling that it isn't a handout, that it isn't ma'am de kisufa, it's not bread of shame, it's something that we're entitled to. That's the whole B'ya Sa'ilam. So the Rebbeinu created people, and now what is the essence of the human being is, he created beings who desire good, greedy beings. So we're ambitious, we're greedy in that sense, and we hate to be indebted, essentially. That's what the Rebbeinu Shem created. So, by promising us all this goodness and giving us the ability to develop it, to earn it ourselves, we can achieve the ultimate purpose of the world. And the whole of society is structured on that principle, except society has changed, and we haven't noticed over the years how society has changed, and that destroys everything. But that really is the principle of everything. Take a person, promise him reward, and give him the opportunity to earn the reward which you've promised. You get productivity. From that you get creativity. When people realize that I can, by working, I can achieve anything. It's open to me. I can get there. If I work for it. Then one has an economy rolling. One has a creative system of society operating. There's enough greed in us and enough ambition in us to want these things. And there's enough of desire for independence for us to want to earn these things. So we roll up our sleeves and we work for it. At least that's how it used to be. Society today is a society which has retained its greed and ambition, but hasn't retained its desire for independence. We don't desire independence so much. We're willing to be dependent, or even worse than that, we don't feel dependent when we're indebted. It doesn't disturb our sense of independence. Being indebted doesn't disturb our sense of independence. And that works nationally and it works individually. That's why you have nations who will fight and kill for their independence. And once they've got their independence, they will engage themselves in debts which they can never repay. And they won't feel they've lost their independence. They still feel independent. Ask them, what's independence? So you've gained political independence and you've lost economic independence. What's better to have? The Chinese in Hong Kong realized a long time ago, political independence, it's nothing, it's a name. Economic independence is the important thing. But it's something the rest of the world doesn't always realize. And we as individuals operate in exactly the same way. We want to be independent. But we don't feel indebtedness as a dependency. That doesn't bother us. And you cannot build ethics on an individual or on a group of individuals who don't mind being indebted. If a person doesn't mind being indebted, he will work as little as he can for the highest salary he can negotiate. And he'll feel comfortable with that. And it's very difficult to do anything with that. Whereas if the natural sense of indebtedness, of discomfort at indebtedness is nurtured within people, they will never feel that way. And the more you pay them, the more they will want to work in order to feel that they're justifying the salary you're offering them. That's if the person is inherently moral. But there's another aspect to it. And that is the question of the morality of creating indebtedness. How good is it, how moral is it to create indebtedness, to make somebody else indebted to you? Is that a good thing to do? So on the surface it isn't. It's not nice to make somebody else indebted to you. But essentially that's what chesed is. Any act of chesed is the creation of indebtedness. That's the definition of chesed. When you do something to another person which makes him indebted to you. That's what chesed is. And that's why Chazal tell us that when you do a chesed for somebody, you've got to tell them. Tzedakah you don't tell people because it's embarrassing. But leaving aside the embarrassment element, if we're not talking about tzedakah, we're talking about chesed, you don't do chesed secretly. Because you lose the whole purpose of chesed. That's really nasty. To do chesed to somebody and not tell them, that's nasty. That means you know they're indebted to you and they don't even know it. That's terribly self-centered. It's a lovely feeling, but it's not a nice thing to do. You don't give them the opportunity to repay their debts. You don't give them the feeling to become independent. You haven't even given them the privilege of knowing that they've lost their independence. It's a very serious thing. So if you want to do a chesed, that's fine. But you've got to tell the person that they've become indebted. And I explained to the ladies this morning that there's a very fine social aspect to business in the Far East, particularly in Japan, which applies in the West as well, but not nearly as sophisticatedly, of the creation of indebtedness. Which is why entertaining is such an important part of the business scene in Japan. The reason is that if before we sit down to serious negotiation I can have you in a position of indebtedness to me, then you're going to find it very difficult to turn down my offer. In fact, it would be totally socially unacceptable to turn down my offer if you're indebted to me. And the way I make you indebted to me is I take you out for dinner. But I'm not such a fool. I know that if I take you out to dinner, you'll take me out to dinner the next night to repay. So I must take you out to dinner in a place which is so expensive that you could never afford to take me out to dinner again. That's how it works. And now when I'm invited to dinner, and I realize what's going on, he's inviting me to dinner, I can imagine just what kind of place he's going to take me to. It's got to be a place which I cannot beat. I've now got to turn that offer down, because if I don't turn that offer down, I'm finished. But if I do turn that offer down, I'm even more finished, because then I'm showing weakness. I'm acknowledging that I've lost the game before we even started. I'm acknowledging I cannot accept it because I can't repay you. That means I'm useless, I'm poor, you're more powerful than me. So I've got to find a way of turning down the invitation in such a way that I don't lose that kind of face. And he of course knows that that's what I'm going to do, so he's got to word the invitation in such a way that I can't turn it down without losing that face. And that's the whole game. That's how it's played long before. By the time you sit down to the negotiation table, it's all been decided already. The one who's going to win, the one who's going to lose, it's all been decided already. And Westerners fall right into it. Send around a young guy, goes overseas, and he's so excited, he's going to negotiate a deal in Japan. And the first night he's there, they invite him out to dinner, and he can't believe his good luck. And the second night they invite him again, and the third night again, and then he's finished. That's it, he's just finished. The creation of indebtedness is something they understand. And they've developed a society that is sensitive to the avoidance of indebtedness. And I'll tell you something, that's the reason their economy is a success. And you won't find that in any of the management books. There are lots of books being written as to why the Japanese economy works so well, and whether it can be tried in America as well, whether we can't try and do the same things in other parts of the world. It's based on the whole system of a discomfort at indebtedness. They don't like to be borrowers, they like to be lenders. They like to have their hands on top at all times, and that's the way the society is structured, and an economy is healthy in such a society. The creation of indebtedness is a very, very powerful tool. It's a powerful tool, of course, it depends who you're using it with. The Americans tried it. They tried to create indebtedness in Africa. So what's happened? The Africans ask for more, and the Americans are going bankrupt in the process. They don't know how to do it. You've got to be careful who you take out to dinner. There's no point in taking somebody out to dinner who loves a free meal and sees nothing wrong with that and doesn't feel in any way indebted. Not at all. The Chazal, the theories that suggest that many of the African nations are the descendants of Ham. The people try and prove it from the Chumash, they try and prove it from Tanakh, which is difficult. There's some indications, but it's difficult. But this element is the best proof. Nations that are willing to be indebted and don't feel uncomfortable, and are willing to say, write off our debt, please. Well, how about that? Write it off and let's start again. That's Avdus. That's a slave. A slave is a person who doesn't mind being indebted. A slave is a person who doesn't want to be a leader, who doesn't want to make a contribution, who doesn't want to take a risk. A slave is a person who's willing to accept handouts. Because what is a slave? Is a person whose output of work is in no way related to the reward he gets. He gets paid standard. He gets paid for his time, he gets paid standard, he got his meals, he's got his roof, he's got everything he needs. His needs are taken care of, and now he has to work. But there is no relationship between his input and his output. That's an evet. And that one sees in Africa and various other nations. The creation of indebtedness can be an immoral thing. To create an indebtedness in somebody who can't repay, to create an indebtedness in somebody who doesn't know what indebtedness means, it's a very, very powerful weapon that has to be used skillfully. But there is such a chiyuv to create indebtedness. Chesed is the creation of indebtedness, provided the other person has the opportunity to respond. And that responsiveness is in fact the dynamics of life. One person doing something for another, the other needing to repay. The Japanese entertainment scene is a little comical cameo of life in general. That's what life is. We do things for each other and we don't feel comfortable at having things done for one another. So we want to do something back. Well, how do you relate to somebody who does feel comfortable? You do something for him and you do again and again and again and again and again. What happens eventually? The relationship dies out. There needs to be feedback. There needs to be response. A relationship cannot thrive when there's not feedback. We discussed this morning, what about child to parents? In the relationship with Ribbono Shel Olam, we see in this Medrash that everything we do is at best a response. Hashem starts. Everything we do, He doesn't ask us to initiate anything. Everything He asks of us is to respond to something which He has initiated. What about child to parent? The same thing. A parent starts. The child only begins to respond at a much later stage. By the time the child starts responding, the parent has given the child life. The parent has sustained the child. There's no way the child can possibly repay. So at best, a child can respond to a parent. At best, in theory, a child can reach equilibrium. But for a child to initiate, that possibility doesn't exist. Which is why I explained that the mitzvah of Kibud Avim appears with the first five of the Ten Commandments, not with the second five. Because we can now explain a little bit more deeply than merely saying the first five is Bein Odom L'Mokrim and the second five is Bein Odom L'Chaveru, and then we're stuck with a question. Why is the honoring of parents on the first five and not on the second five? We can redefine it a little bit and say the first five are those mitzvahs initiated by the Ribbono Shel Olam, or those mitzvahs where the mitzvah is at best a response. The second five are mitzvahs which man can initiate. Mitzvahs Bein Odom L'Chaveru, we can play God. We can do the initiating. When we're dealing with one another, we can initiate. When we're dealing with the Ribbono Shel Olam, we can only respond. And that is the concept of Matnos Shamayim. Realizing that everything we have is given to us in order to create an indebtedness which will demand a response. There's a Gemara in Avodah Zarah, Daf Mendalo Amud Beis. Tanu Rabbanan, we learned in the Braisa, Sholu Philosophian Nesazakenim Beroimi. The philosophers asked the Chachomim in Rome, Im Elokeichem Ein Ritzoinoi Be'avodas Kichovim Mipnemo Einu Mevatlo. If you're right that your God doesn't want idolatry, why doesn't God just cancel it out? Why doesn't He just remove it? Omru Lohem, they said to Him, Ilu L'dovu She'en Ha'ilam Tzirich Lo Yehayu Oivdim Harehu Mevatlo. If people served things that the world didn't need, Hashem could just have removed it. But what do people serve? They serve the sun and the moon and the stars. Do you want God to destroy the whole world because of a few idiots? The world follows its normal rules. The shoitim shekilkulu, and those stupid people who disturb the equilibrium, atzidim osidim liten esadin, they will have to account for it in the future. Dover Acher, another example. Hareshe gozal sol shil chitim, v'holach zuron bekarko. If a person stole a measure of seed and planted them in the ground, dinu shel etitzmach. Really, it shouldn't grow. That would be the easiest thing to do. You should be punished for it there and then. Elo ilam kibin hagel noyeg, but the world follows normal, natural rules. V'holach and carries on. V'shoitim shekilkulu asidim nisines adin. And the stupid people who are devious will have to account for it. Another example, if a man has relations with the wife of his friend, the best thing would be that there should be no consequence from that relationship. But it doesn't happen. She can fall pregnant and have a child, and you've got mamzerus. Various examples of how the Ribbono Shel Olam allows us to use the laws of nature to destroy the world if necessary. He's given us the rules and allows us to operate them. And here we have examples of being able to take things which are not Matnos Shamayim. Through one's own efforts, one can do things which will result in benefits that was not God's intention, so to say. And what is the test? How do we know what we're doing? Let's go back to the Bnei Gad and the Bnei Reuven. Moshe gets very angry with them. Now, this is the second time in the parasha that Moshe has got angry with the Bnei Yisrael. The first time was a little bit earlier, where they didn't wipe out the Midianim properly, and he says to them, "To Vayikzos Moshe al Pekudei Echoyel," and Moshe got angry with the army. You left the females alive and so on. Moshe gets angry. Later on, when Bnei Yisrael are given the halachas of how to kasher the kelim of the Midianites, they had spoil, they had various kitchen utensils, and Moshe, and they're given the laws of kashering the kelim. It says, "Vayomer elozur akoyin el anshei atzova abayim namil chomo zoyz chukas atzorah shetziva Hashem es Moshe." Elozur, the Kohen, tells the army generals who've come back from the war what the chukas atzorah is, what the laws now are of kashering, which Hashem commanded Moshe. Says Rashi, "Lefi shebo Moshe lichlal kas." Why did Moshe not teach us? Moshe was the rov. Moshe was the person who should have been teaching us. Why elozur akoyin? "Lefi shebo Moshe lichlal kas bo lichlal tos." Because Moshe got angry with the Bnei Yisrael, he came to make a mistake. He lost the extreme degree of clarity that he previously had in understanding the laws of kashering the kelim. And so Elozar HaKohen had to do it, which was a terrible punishment for Moshe, that it should be recorded for all generations that he couldn't teach this parsha, because he didn't have clarity. Why didn't he have clarity? Because he got angry with the Bnei Yisrael. Yet later on, when he gets angry with the Bnei Gad and the Bnei Reuven, and he attacks them and says, "You're going to make your brother scared, and don't you remember what happened last time this occurred?" We don't find that he's punished for it. We don't find that in any place he loses his clarity, or that Hashem accuses him of having gotten angry with the Bnei Yisrael. So that anger seems to have been fully justified. Moshe was able to perceive, at least subconsciously, in the claim and in the suggestion of the Bnei Reuven and the Bnei Gad to stay on that side of the Jordan, that there was an element of fear, that there was an element of self-interest, of desire to stay on that side so as to escape the turmoil and the toil of the war that would take place on the other side of the Jordan. And the Midrash brings this as an example of people who got their wealth not as a matzono min HaKadosh Baruch Hu, not as a gift from God. Let's take it one step further, where the Midrash says in the beginning, when are these three gifts which are keys to the entire world, is provided, bizman shein matnoi shamayim uvois bekeach hatzira, provided they are gifts of heaven and come with the energy of Torah. What does Matna Shemayim mean, and what does Bois Bekeach HaTorah? So we've defined Matna Shemayim already. When God gives us something to create an indebtedness, He gives us something and wants to see what we do with it. As the Medrash said in Eiv, "I gave you the talis, you make the tzitzis. I give you the house, you put on the mezuzahs, you put up the makkah, you do the mitzvahs that are tied to the house." So all the material things that God has given us are there to create within us a desire to respond according to the Torah, according to the Halach. What happens when we take that which God has given us and we don't see it in that light? We don't see our physical wealth, our material well-being, as kelim, as utensils, as tools to serve the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's the test which the Bnei Gad and the Bnei Reuven failed. They've got great wealth. They've got cattle. What should they want to do now with this wealth? How should they see this wealth? They should want more than anything to be in the midst of Israel, of the society of Yisrael, so that they can use this wealth for the benefit of the klal. They've got to do something with it. If they see that this is a matnos shamayim, if they see that this has come as a gift of shamayim, they've got to realize that this is there to be invested. This is there with which to build, with which to develop. And where then should they choose to live? In the middle of it all they should want to live. What is their choice? They want to live on the outskirts. Why? Because that's in their best business interests. Now, there are two kinds of business interests. There's a business interest which is viewed from the point of view of developing my own assets, and there's the business interests viewed from the point of view of using my assets for the development of my society. And you remember we discussed last week that through the investment, through creative investment, the results automatically, the fruit comes. And that's what Torah business really is. To take those assets and to invest them correctly in society, whether the assets are mental assets, whether the assets are physical assets, whatever talents, whatever gifts one has, whether the assets are material assets, to see those as kalim that have been given to me to enable me to interact with people, to make a contribution in the world in which I'm operating, to make a contribution in the society in which I'm operating. If that's the way I see my wealth, then I see it as matnas shamayim. Everything is matnas shamayim. Everything comes from Hashem. But there are those things which I see as God responding to my efforts, and there are those things which I see as me having to respond to God's efforts. The example the Gemara gives in Avodah Zorah, where a man steals seeds and he plants them. A man has a relationship with somebody who isn't his wife. What do we say? View them as a gift of God, they demand response. If I view them as self-initiated, they don't. How do the B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven? They take their assets, and what do they want to do with it? Let's keep them here, where they're safe. The desire, the intent, is the accumulation of assets rather than the investment of assets. If one wants assets for the sake of accumulating, that's not seeing it as matnas shamayim. Assets are given to us to invest, not to accumulate. Wisdom is given to us to invest, not to accumulate. Money is given to us to invest, not to accumulate. To invest in tzedakah, in chesed, and in business. In doing things, as we discussed previously, that productive business is also chesed. One creates employment, one creates opportunities, one betters people's lives. But in any form of productive involvement, there is an element of chesed. And everything that one has, every asset that one has, is meant to be invested in the world, is meant to be put into the world to make the world a better place, not to be accumulated safely where it can't be damaged. And when B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven take their cattle, which was clearly a gift of God, a matnas shamayim, how else could they have got it after 40 years in the desert? And their desire is for security rather than for investment in society. They're willing to sit on the fringes of society. They're willing to be on the other side of the Jordan, far away from the action, far from Yerushalayim, far from the whole civilized world of Eretz Israel. They're willing to be the furthest tribes from that, just to keep their assets safe. That's not matnas shamayim. That's not the way you respond to matnas shamayim. If you see your assets as gifts of God, they create a desire, a need within you to respond. You've got to repay. That means you've got to use your assets for the benefits of society. You've got to invest the assets back into society. These are not matnas shamayim. We've dealt with certain elements in the Medrash. We don't have the time at the moment to deal with others. What Koyach HaTorah means. What is it? That it's not sufficient that it's a matnas shamayim. It has to come also from Koyach HaTorah, from the energy of Torah. But just very briefly, the development of assets, even if it's a matnas shamayim, usually requires some degree of effort. The Ribbono Shel Olam doesn't, to my knowledge anyway, just open the heavens and let the gold coins land up on your table. It doesn't work that way. Even if it's matnas shamayim, you have to work for it. The question is, what is the source of the energy that drives you to work? Because one has to energize oneself. There has to be a source of energy. There has to be a motivation. What is it that drives one to work? If it is merely the desire for the accumulation of wealth, then that's one kind of energy. But there's something else which is called Koyach HaTorah, the energy which comes from Torah. The person has sat down for a couple of hours and had a really good learning session with a chavrusa. He has to shear first. Let's do the whole thing. He spends 2 hours with a chavrusa preparing a shear. He then goes into a shear for an hour, comes out of the shear and spends another 2 hours revising the shear. So he's had a 5-hour session, and he comes out on a high. He's elated, he's worked, he's sweated, he's expanded his mind, he's tired, but he comes out on a high. There's energy there. That energy can now be directed in several different ways. He can choose what to do with that energy. But it's energy which has a kedusha to it. It's energy which has been generated by the Torah. And the directions that one will choose to channel that energy are very different to the directions one will choose when the energy has not sourced itself from a holy source, from an origin of kedusha. The Vilna Gaon used to advise people when they need to make tough decisions to close themselves up for 7 hours and learn Torah with all their might, and then make the decision after that 7-hour session. And he says the first, but quickly, you just make your decision quickly. You close your Gemara and you make your decision, and that's it. And the decision will be a good decision. It will be a decision inspired by kedusha, because the energy that you will be using will be the energy of kedusha. I'll say we don't have time to develop this idea, but I want to leave you with a concept that one can energize oneself from all sorts of different sources. When one is energizing oneself from Torah, the use of that energy will be a Torah use as well, will be a Torah direction. It's true that the Bnei Gad and the Bnei Reuven got their cattle min ha-shamayim. There's never been a case where it has been more obvious that wealth has come from the Ribbono Shel Olam. It is a matnas shamayim. But there was that other side of the condition that the Medrash laid. It has to be the Koyach HaTorah. And if one had invested one's Koyach HaTorah in one's business, imagine that. Imagine that that all the energy that Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven put into their business affairs was generated from Torah, they would not have been willing to opt for fringe society in order to look after their business interests. When one's business is energized by Torah, one isn't willing to sacrifice Torah for one's business. The price is too high. Then one is willing to sacrifice business for Torah, but not the other way around. In this session we'll have opportunities later on to talk about that. The point that I want to conclude on is actually a word of farewell to Rabbi Tesler, who's been a part of the shir for a number of weeks during his time in South Africa, and I want to firstly thank him for the kovod he's shown to me. I know that he's not sitting in the shir because there's anything he can learn here that he would otherwise not know. I know that he sees that as a means of investing in the society in which he's operating and in which he's been living for the last few weeks, and thankfully comes back regularly. And I want to say, as I've said previously, that this whole concept of response and indebtedness is important also in the way one gives tzedakah and in the way one collects tzedakah. There are people who raise money in a way which leaves the donor feeling drained. Why? I've given him money. What now? What did I get for it? I'm used to spending money and getting something in return. I've given money, good, fine. So sometimes the way that's being handled now in South Africa more and more is COVID is given instead. Give money and we'll name a room after you. When you come to Israel, we'll make a banquet for you. We'll do things for you. Don't worry, we'll pay you back. And I've wondered, this is actually a new dimension to fundraising in South Africa. It was always known until fairly recently that you couldn't tempt South Africans with COVID. Americans, yes, but not South Africans. And fundraisers who used to come from Israel used to know that. It wouldn't help offering a person to name the building after him. He was likely to say, you know what, take the money, but on one condition. Don't name the building. Just leave me out of it. Here's the money, give them to hate, enjoy it, use it for whatever it's meant to be used for, but no COVID, please. Just leave me out of it. That used to be the style. It's no longer the style, I understand from the fundraisers, that now people are willing to take COVID. And in discussing it with fundraisers, most people feel because South Africans have changed. I don't believe that's so. I believe it's because fundraisers have changed. And it used to be in the times that Rosh Yeshiva used to come here, a balabos used to give money responding, not initiating. He felt so enriched after the visit of the donor, of the collector. He felt so high, he felt so stimulated and honored already, that he felt a need to respond. And his tzedakah was his way of responding to the experience of having spent an hour in the presence of a great man. It doesn't need any COVID offer. That would spoil it. It's back to the Japanese trick. Then by giving me the COVID, you're making me still more indebted. You've given me a wonderful hour. Here's 20,000 rand. Good. It's kutznah. Now at least I feel I've done something for you too. The moment fundraisers start coming and not giving, not investing, it's a matter then of taking as much as can be taken. Then the donor feels, I need something in return. What am I getting out of it? So he's offered COVID, he's offered this, he's offered that. There are relatively few fundraisers today that come to South Africa with a view of my job here is to invest. My job here is not to take. My job is to build and so on. I've told you often, we can ask the same question as the philosophers asked the Chachamim in Rome. If the Ribbono Shel Olam wants yeshivas to exist, why did he make so little money available for them? Why did he make the Rosh Yeshivas have to run all over the world to raise money? Surely they can do more by staying at home and teaching Torah. And the Chofetz Chaim used to say that the reason was to make the rest of the world a part of that process. Otherwise there would be isolation. They would be there, we would never see them. And I told you once that a Rosh Yeshiva suggested to me that that's the way he sees his... the Rosh Yeshiva, he was a Meshulach, he was a fundraiser. But that's the way he sees his role. To give us the opportunity of giving money. That's what the Chofetz Chaim meant. And I explained to him that that's not what the Chofetz Chaim meant. For if that was what the Chofetz Chaim meant, then God would have arranged it in such a way that the Rosh Yeshiva stay in Israel, and they would simply have to send out letters. Please send money. And we would send money back. They don't have to come traveling. That's all that would happen. If the purpose was that we should be involved in the mitzvah of Hachzokas Torah through the donation of money, then there's a simple way to do it. We send our money overseas. The reason is that our money has to be in response to exposure to them as personalities. The Ribbono Shel Olam didn't just want us to be giving them money. The Ribbono Shel Olam wanted them to come so that we could see them and benefit from them and learn from them and be exposed to them. And in response to that, give money. That's a relationship. And it's the relationship that has to be there. And I would just like to say that Rabbi Tesler is one of those people who invests. I've never heard him ask for money. I don't know if he actually raises money. I don't know if he gets anything while he's out here. I've never heard him ask for money. I've just heard him taking an interest in everything around him, putting in, investing. Whatever he does make here is nothing compared to what he leaves behind here. And I want him to know how much we appreciate that and value that, and we feel a part of his work. We wish him Hatzlocha. We thank him for what he's put into the Beis HaMedrash, into the community in general, and look forward in it, Hashem, to seeing him again.